Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. Have you ever noticed how much time we spend thinking about the future?
If the mind's not doing anything important, it's going to think about the future instead.
Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future.
The future is ours to win.
The sweep and the grandeur, the scoop and the laughter, the future, the future.
The future's not uncovered, what will be discovered.
The geeks are running everything. It's kind of freakishly prescient.
Yeah!
And it's very hard to beat the dart-throwing chimpanzee when you're trying to predict that far out.
You're gonna take a walk in the rain and you're gonna get wet.
And the date and the sun will fade out. Yes, the sun will fade out. The sun will fade out. And the date.
From the weather report to political campaigns to the stock market, everything's about the future. Predicting it, owning it, winning it. For something that hasn't even happened yet, the future occupies an awful lot of our lives and thoughts. But why? Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, let's find out.
Hal, why do you think we're so obsessed with the future right now?
There's a lot of reasons, but the main reason is because we perceive the present to be a very anxious place. We have climate change, we have terrorism, we have unemployment problems. We're obsessed with the future because we want to get to a present that is not so anxiety-inducing.
That's Canadian cultural critic Hal Nidbiedzky talking with Doug Gordon. Hal's the author of Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. It's a book in which he makes the case that as a culture, we may be, for the first time in history, more focused on the future than on what's happening right now. He thinks it's a kind of escapism. For example,
what is the fastest-selling category of automobile in America right now? I'll throw that out to you, Doug.
Okay, thank you, Hal. We'll insert the Jeopardy music here. I'm going to guess sport utility vehicles? No. I give up. Kirill knows. Our technical director knows, but I don't know.
It is, in fact, the luxury SUV.
Oh, okay. So I was partly right.
You were partly right. That is the most popular category of vehicle in America. And you say to yourself, how is that possible with all the kind of enthusiasm and consternation around the environment and enthusiasm for electric vehicles and all this stuff? But then you look at the bigger picture, and Elon Musk, who is, of course, this billionaire technologist and the founder of Tesla Motors, the all-electronic car company, what does he put out? He puts out a luxury SUV Tesla, which costs $132,000. And when he puts this vehicle out into the world, he says, this car is so amazing, and here's the quote, it's like a car from the future. So there's this through line that tells us, you know what, we don't have to change. We don't have to consider making changes to our lifestyle in the face of all these problems. All we have to do is wait for people like Elon Musk to turn our luxury SUV into an all-electric SUV, and then our problems are solved. The future is coming.
Yeah. In his 2011 State of the Union address, President Barack Obama said that the first step in winning the future is encouraging American innovation. What does Obama mean when he talks about winning the future?
Well, I'm sure that he doesn't really have a sense of what he means in the sense that this is just rhetoric. These are lines tossed off by presidents, politicians, masters of technology and industry, and they're all running around saying, we have to have innovation, we have to win the future or own the future. When you think about this in the abstract, it doesn't mean anything because how can you ever own the future, right?
Right.
The future keeps coming and it can't be owned. On the other hand, there is an actual meaning that we're seeing in society. So the need to make this concrete is becoming more evident. And what actually is happening is we are fundamentally restructuring the institutions that make up our society and our culture in order to win the future or own the future or get to the future first. So when you look at education, when you look at government, when you look at how we organize the labor force, we see that all these things are being restructured to privilege this idea of owning the future. And the idea of owning the future essentially is that we need to constantly disrupt the present through technology in order to put the elements in play that will allow us to have a kind of total technological control of the time to come.
Yeah. This idea of disrupting the present is really evident in education. Schools are teaching the future. For example, USC opened a new program just last year, I believe, 2014, with the slogan, "The degree is in disruption." What's going on in education?
In the book, I devote a whole chapter to education because it really is a nexus where you can see how all this is playing out. So what we have is reordering of the education system to privilege getting to the future first. Everyone is coming up with new degrees which teach some variation on coding, entrepreneurship, and innovation. At the same time, we have a complete collapse of study in the humanities, underfunded, trying to kind of slowly diminish these programs. A great example is at Stanford, where the main degree is by far the computer science degree. And at Stanford, you have 45% of the faculty still teaching the humanities, but only 15% of the students take their classes.
Wow.
So you can see where this is going, right?
Yeah.
When these tenured professors retire, you can't really imagine them being replaced when no one's taking their classes. And of course, Stanford's a very rich university, and this is being reflected all over the U.S., where there are schools that are actually either canceling parts of their humanities programs or they're trying to redo them. So, for instance, at Brigham Young University in Utah, they rename their entire humanities department Humanities Plus, shades of Google Plus. And in the Humanities Plus department, yeah, okay, you study a little English, a little history, a little philosophy, but more importantly, you partner up with the business students and you come up with innovations.
Yeah. As you say, there's this whole paradox here in this future-first education model, because education is traditionally a field that transmits past knowledge, things that have already happened. And now education is trying more and more to teach not what we already know, this body of common knowledge and history, but what we don't know. It's like students are attending Nostradamus High. What do you make of this?
I find it tremendously sad and kind of anti-human that we want to erase the past and focus squarely on the future. And the future is purely a technological thing. You know, it's the turn of a switch. It's AI and robots and downloading our brains into computers and living in virtual lives. The past is old and boring and human. The future is new and exciting and not human. It's profoundly anti-human. You know, the other factor, of course, is that there's the sense that the past won't help you get a job. And this is what really pulls the students, the schools, and the government funders all together in the same direction, is this belief that the students, there's no jobs for them if they just simply learn how to think about things. They have to learn how to be innovative and create. As Google put an ad for a product manager out there, and it said they're looking for someone who can bring innovative, world-changing products to market. So that's the skill you need. You know, and to ask our young people, to ask anyone really, can you bring world-changing products to market? There's a reason we have an epidemic of mental illness in North American society, because these are the questions that we're asking and putting on people. It's very problematic, and it's very destabilizing for all concerned. There is comforts that come from learning about the past, learning about how your culture and society survived and grew.
One of the innovations you talk about is the use of big data to manage forests, and that seems like such a great thing that it's hard to argue with. And it raises the question how you think we should move forward in terms of finding this balance between the upside, the positive powers of digital technologies, and the downsides, antisocial and negative uses of digital technologies, like putting people out of work and things. Is there something that needs to be done, something we can do to find this kind of balance?
You know, that's a really hard question to resolve, because we are so psychologically attuned to the future and we really see the future as something that will save us because of the way that we use the future in the past, in the times of prehistory. You know, we're still basically just kind of lizard people lying on rocks, you know, waiting for something shiny to fly by that we can eat. We haven't changed that much. So I think we need to start with that understanding that most people are extremely psychologically susceptible to narratives about the future because they believe that that narrative will enhance the information they need for survival in the present day. And if we could all understand better that our desire for future is actually the desire for a more stable present, I think then we can start to ask these questions. Does this technology give us what we really want? What we really want is social certainty, continuity, community, and the assurance that we can, you know, live in our communities without being suddenly cast aside. You are now obsolete. So we have to look at each technology and say, how does this get us to what we really want?
Hal Nidbiedzky is the author of Trees on Mars, Our Obsession with the Future. He talked with Doug Gordon. Coming up, so-called super forecasters are ordinary people who can somehow predict the future more accurately than intelligence analysts, who have access to classified information. How do they do it? And could the rest of us learn how? I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. There are professionals who predict the future, and I don't mean astrologers. I'm talking about people you and I consult all the time, weather forecasters, stock market analysts, Nate Silver. They make a living using complex algorithms to analyze reams of data. So what if I told you that untrained, non-expert, ordinary people can outpredict them? Philip Tetlock is a political psychologist who spent 20 years studying expert judgment. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him about what he calls super forecasting, the art and science of prediction.
Phil, you say we are all forecasters. In what way?
Well, it's very hard to do anything in life in a rational way without trying to estimate what will happen if you go down one path or another. If you marry one person or another, you take one job or another, you move to one city or another, you vote for one candidate or another, on and on. We're basing those decisions on implicit or explicit guesses about what's going to happen if we do something. And the premise of this entire project is that we're better off being more explicit than implicit about the guesses we're making.
So we can actually learn to make better guesses. I mean, this is a talent we can cultivate.
That is the core issue that the U.S. intelligence community wanted to study 5 years ago when they launched this series of forecasting tournaments, is probability estimation of messy real-world events, a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating.
So are the quote experts, are they really that good at making predictions?
It really depends on the type of time frame and type of question we're talking about. In the early work, we were asking the subject matter experts to look far out into time, 3, 5, 10 years out. And it's very hard to beat the dart-throwing chimpanzee when you're trying to predict that far out. In the later work, we were looking at forecasts in a more short-term horizon, 3 to 18 months roughly. And that turns out to be sort of a Goldilocks zone in which you can identify talent.
Mm-hmm. So you and your wife and research partner, Barbara Mellers, started something called the Good Judgment Project a few years ago. What were you trying to do with this project?
Well, about 6 years ago, my wife and I were still on the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, and we received a visit from three gentlemen from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and they informed us of their plan to run a competition, a series of forecasting tournaments, and Barbara and I were in charge of one of the research teams. There were five major research universities and consultancies that were in competition with each other. The Intelligence Committee was in the role of the pitcher. It was throwing questions at us, and we were in the role of the batters. We were trying to hit the questions out of the park without striking out. 4 years and 500 questions later, the Good Judgment Project did emerge as the winner of the forecasting tournament. In fact, we'd won the forecasting tournament pretty decisively after the first 2 years, so some of the teams were consolidated after that point. But the basic idea is, can you get better at this?
So these are all, I mean, they're difficult questions, but they're all real-world questions. You're grappling with the stuff out there that decision-makers have to deal with.
We're out in the wild. These aren't artificial laboratory problems with artificial laboratory tricks. This is the real thing.
So is this a matter of, I mean, people who are super smart with mathematics, I mean, sort of being able to do probabilities and all of that? Is that the key here?
Well, it doesn't hurt. But it's certainly not a necessary condition for being a super forecaster. We have a lot of super forecasters who don't know a lot of math or statistics. They do, however, tend to be numerate. They're comfortable with numbers, but they don't have to be mathematically profound.
When you say they're good with numbers, I mean, they're good at assessing the odds. I mean, it's like, so okay, there's a 60% chance that this thing is going to happen. I mean, they sort of have that sense of probability.
Exactly. So in the book, we report an interview with the chief risk officer of a hedge fund in New York City, Aaron Brown, who also happens to be a very serious poker player, a world-class poker player. And he said the way you can tell the difference between a world-class player and a talented amateur is that world-class players can more reliably tell the difference between 60-40 bets and 40-60 bets. And then he paused and said, oh, it's more like 55-45, 45-55. They think it's a skill worth cultivating, and they become quite adept at distinguishing more degrees of uncertainty than most human beings think it's worthwhile to distinguish. There's no real argument, I think, in most people's minds that's possible in poker, that you're better off over the long term betting on the person who has the better appreciation of probability, even though that you know that person won't win every hand. You know that on the long run, the odds will favor a person who is better at estimating the odds. The question is, can you also do better on questions such as whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, or whether there'll be a violent clash between China and Japan in the East China Sea, or things that have the potential to alter world history?
Right. Well, it seems like those are not ultimately questions where you can really assign probabilities. I mean, that's sort of informed analysis, trying to figure out the shape of world events.
Well, that's exactly the attitude that many people in the intelligence community had to the proposal to run a forecasting tournament. The National Intelligence Council at the time was distinguishing 5 degrees of uncertainty in its national intelligence estimates. It could say that things were very likely, quite likely, unsure, quite unlikely, very unlikely. 5 degrees of uncertainty, that's it. No numbers, just subjective assessments along that scale. So the question was, could we do better than that? Could we reliably make more subtle distinctions among degrees of uncertainty than that 5-level scale that was being used by the National Intelligence Council? And the answer, I mean, there's a scientific answer to this, and that is our best forecasters and our best algorithms and our best teams were able to distinguish somewhere between 15 and 20 degrees of uncertainty.
Wow.
And they were also able to outpredict intelligence analysts with access to classified information.
You brought together people who are not professionals in these areas, and you're pitting them against the people in the U.S. intelligence agencies, and your forecasters are doing better?
Right. Well, in fairness to everybody here, we should say that the 500 questions asked were very heterogeneous. So no one individual is going to be an expert on any more than a fairly small fraction of the questions. I mean, there's nobody who's an expert on Sino-Japanese naval conflict and Eurozone financial stability and H5N1, although simultaneously. So everybody, to some degree, is having to function as a talented amateur and improviser in response to the questions that are being pitched at them any given week.
So what did your team – why was it so effective? Why was it better than the quote, professional forecasters?
I think it comes back to this core idea that our forecasters really were curious whether this was a skill that could be cultivated and was worth cultivating, so they worked really hard at it. A lot of very thoughtful people inside the U.S. intelligence community quite understandably had the attitude that you just expressed, which is, hey, yeah, sure, odds matter in poker, but how can you possibly assess the odds of whether Greece is going to leave the Eurozone in the summer of 2015? You can't go back in your time machine to the summer of 2015 and rerun history 100 times and see how often Greece left the Eurozone and say, oh, well, it's 14% of the time. That was the probability. You can't do that. And so therefore, most people have a mental block and they say, look, probability estimation of those events is therefore impossible. But that's a little too extreme. It's true you can't go back in history and rerun it and observe the distribution of outcomes, but there are things you can do. You can say, how likely is Greece to leave the Eurozone? Given that, the weighted average of our best forecasters at this juncture in time is 14%, and we know that those forecasters are very well calibrated, so that on average, when they say events of this sort are 14% likely, they tend to occur about 14% of the time. So you can do that. And that is a lot better than nothing.
So if we just play out this one example for a moment, I mean, will Greece leave the Eurozone or, I mean, by a particular date, what would be some factors that would go into making that guess?
Well, I'm not a super forecaster, so you should really be interviewing the super forecasters about how they work their magical forecasting operations. But they're not magical at all. They're very public and transparent. So on the Grexit question, I think they might start by asking, how often do you see forced currency conversions in international economics? Not very often. How many prior crises of Greek exit have there been, and how have they resolved themselves? Have any other countries ever left the Eurozone? And if Greece did leave the Eurozone, do they have a viable plan? Or was the Greek leadership just bluffing? Do they have a plan B? And if they don't have a plan B, that's certainly a sign that they may well be bluffing, which they turned out to be.
Right. So are there certain character traits, personality traits that go into the making of a super forecaster?
Well, the most important one, I think, is this attitude that this is a skill that's worth cultivating and I'm going to work at cultivating it. So it's a gritty determination to get better at this. And it requires a certain amount of grit. I mean, it requires grit to learn how to play the piano. But if you had to try to learn to play a piano in which a demon comes into your house every couple of months and changes the location of the keys, it would be pretty exasperating. So learning to forecast world politics, it's a bit like that, because you can get very good at predicting patterns in a given year or in a given region, and then suddenly the rules may shift. So you have to relearn things fast. And that's something super forecasters are just willing to do. I mean, they know that they're going to be wrong, sometimes very wrong, sometimes.
So they have to be very open-minded. They have to be willing to change their mind.
They have to be willing to change their minds. And they have to be willing, after reality knocks them on the chin, they have to be willing to get up and dust themselves off and get back into it.
Philip Tetlock teaches politics and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and the Wharton School of Business. He's the co-author, along with Dan Gardner, of Super Forecasting: The Art and Science of Prediction. Steve Paulson talked with him. So I don't know about you, but the older I get, the faster the years seem to go by. Time does that. Speeds up and slows down in mysterious ways. I mean, a minute is always 60 seconds, but it can seem like forever if you're waiting online. Or it can seem like nothing at all if you're also playing Angry Birds. Science journalist Claudia Hammond explains some of these mysteries in a book called Time Warped. Among them, why we are so drawn to thinking about the future.
We spend a lot of time thinking about the future. And so if you put people in a brain scanner and get them to think of nothing and you say, just don't think of anything at all or stare at this cross that's on the screen, one of the most common things for people to do is to think about the future. Even if it's just what they're going to eat that night, you can't help but plan ahead. And so it's almost as if it's a kind of default mode. If the mind's not doing anything important, it's going to think about the future instead.
That's fascinating that our default is to think about the future, not the present. Doesn't that seem sort of like a shame?
Well, it's a useful thing. You know, people will often say, oh, they're trying desperately to be in the moment. But it's no accident that we do think about the future. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Humans have always been very good at planning ahead, of wondering, oh, why don't we tomorrow all go and see what's over the other side of that hill, or, you know, have that curiosity and plan for things. And this has been, many would argue, part of humans' success. And so we are, unlike other animals, particularly good at planning, particularly good at planning ahead and working out what we're going to do. And so we need to think about the future. It's a good thing.
I guess the question is whether it makes us happy or unhappy. I mean, we all visualize the future in many different ways. Seems like half my time I spend worrying about the future.
Yes, I mean, that is the trouble. If your thinking becomes obsessed with worrying about the bad things, then obviously, you know, that's not going to be such a good thing. There does tend to be a bit of an optimism bias in that a lot of the time we think better things will happen in the future. I mean, one of the things people think about the future is that they will have more spare time. And there is no evidence that we'll have any more spare time in the future. We like to think we'll be kind of better organized versions of ourselves and be able to get more things done. In fact, unfortunately, that's quite unlikely unless you know, decide to do something differently. But this is the reason why the planning fallacy is so common, where you think you can get something done much more quickly than you can. So even if it's, you know, that you think you can build yourself a kitchen in a weekend, and, you know, 3 weeks later you still haven't even got a sink put in. Government procurement projects will overrun by miles and miles because we all think we'll have more time in the future and be more organized and better.
So what actually goes on in the brain when we visualize or think about the future?
Well, it's really interesting because one of the things that we're particularly good at is mental time travel, if you like. And this is the thing that we think other animals can't do. So some animals can plan where they, say, bury food, hide food for winter. But what they can't do is to throw themselves mentally into the future, whereas we can do that. And so we can time travel at will, if you like, in our minds. You know, I can say, imagine that next week you're going on a red double-decker bus to a Caribbean island to go to, I don't know, some famous film star, Johnny Depp's wedding or something like that. And I tell you to imagine you're doing that next weekend. You can already picture those things. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is that what you're doing in order to picture those things is you are putting together little fragments of past memories. It's almost like you're sort of cutting together all those little film clips of having seen a red double-decker bus and Johnny Depp and all those different things and putting them all together. You're building the future out of the past, and this actually is one of the reasons, I think, why our memories can be so fallible. So we will, you know, curse the fact that we can't remember everything as well as we might like to be able to. And obviously that becomes particularly important when it's, say, witnesses to crimes. And there's been loads of experiments showing how in certain circumstances it's easy to get a witness in experiments to become unreliable and to think they might have seen things they haven't even. And yet the reason for this is so that we can splice together, if you like, these little bits of memories to be able to think of the future. And so there are really interesting parallels between future thinking and thinking about the past, to the extent that people with certain sorts of amnesia also find it difficult to imagine the future. They've done experiments where they ask people to imagine that they're going to a museum at the weekend, and they say, what do you think the museum might look like inside? People with amnesia will find that very, very difficult to imagine what that museum might look like, even though it's something they're conjuring out of their imagination. But we know that the areas of the brain are very, very similar that do those different things.
But that's fascinating because, for instance, what if you take somebody who's had a miserable past, an unhappy childhood? Are they likely to, when they construct their particular vision of the future, construct an unhappy vision of the future?
Well, not necessarily. It's interesting. I mean, some people will still be optimistic despite what has happened to them. They will be very hopeful that things will be better. Others, you know, you can get pessimists who've had perfectly happy lives but who are convinced everything's going to go wrong from now on. Or you sometimes hear people say that they think it's better to look not on the bright side, if you like, on the dark side, because then they won't be disappointed if things don't turn out the way they want. Then they'll be pleasantly surprised instead. So you can also get people almost using it as a deliberate coping strategy to try to be more pessimistic about the future.
So are you saying that when we visualize the future, we're actually using the same part of our brains that we use to store our memories?
Yes, there's quite good evidence for that, that several of the same parts of the brain will be used for that. And so those parts of the brain are also ones that if they get damaged, then it will be difficult for people to think of the future. And they're also little, very small children don't have such rich autobiographical memories, memories of their own things that they've been doing, as older children and adults do. And the same thing happens with little children. They find it hard to imagine the future. So in one experiment, they asked children who were 4 years old to suggest what they might do the next day. And then they asked their parents to judge whether this was a plausible thing that they might do the next day. And it was allowed to be exciting if they wanted. They could say they might be going to the zoo next day in hope. But fewer than half of them were actually able to pitch themselves forward into the future to imagine something plausible at all. They almost didn't have that skill yet of imagining the future, just as they also didn't have the same memory skills as we do. And another experiment that I really like with children, they gave children some salty pretzels to eat, and then they asked them, would they like some water or some more pretzels? And the children would choose water. And then they say to them, what would you like now? And they say they'd like some more pretzels. And they say, tomorrow, if we'd given you some pretzels, what will you choose to have next tomorrow? And they can't imagine that they might feel thirsty tomorrow. So instead, they say that what they'd like tomorrow is more pretzels. Whereas if you ask the adults, they can predict that what they want is the pretzels and then the water and then the pretzels. But the small children can't.
Huh. So as we age, we get better at predicting and imagining the future.
Yeah, we do. Through childhood, we definitely get better at it. But we don't all see it in the same way. There's this brilliant question. I could ask you this question, which is, if I were to say to you, there's a meeting on Wednesday, but Wednesday's meeting is being moved forward 2 days, what day do you think Wednesday's meeting is now? There are two possible answers to that question. What would you say for that?
Friday.
So Wednesday's meeting's being moved forward. You say Friday. I'd immediately say Monday. And if you ask a big room of people, this question completely splits the room. Half will say Monday and half will say Friday. And people will all turn to each other and say, don't be stupid. Of course it can't be that.
It can't be. You said you'd move the meeting forward. That means
forwards.
The meeting's moving forward. It's advancing to Friday.
Yeah, and some people will think, oh, well, that means the time is moving forward instead, and so the meeting is coming nearer. And so, I mean, I've often had this with talking about, you know, radio programs with my boss, and my boss will say, oh, that program you're doing, it's been moved forward a month. And I'll go, oh, no, I don't know if I've got time. I don't know if I've got time. She'll say, I thought you would be pleased. It's a month away. You've got a month longer. And I say, no, it doesn't mean that. And these represent two different ways that people look at time. And so the people who answer Monday, like me, this is known as the time-moving metaphor. And it's the idea that you see yourself at a point in time and the future is coming towards you. So, you know, spring is coming or the summer is coming or Christmas is coming. You're standing still and it's coming towards you. Mm. People who answer Friday, like you, that metaphor is the ego-moving metaphor. And they see themselves as moving off into the future and that they're the ones that they're going off towards the time that's ahead of them. And so they see it another way. But what's amazing is even that can change. And so with things we're dreading, like going to the dentist, people are much more likely to then change their answer and say Monday because they're seeing the dentist appointment as coming towards them. There's nothing you can do about it. It's getting nearer and nearer and it's coming to get you, if you like.
The other thing you said that's so fascinating is that you were talking about how much of what we imagine in the future is based on, kind of remixed from the past, and yet our past memories are so fallible. I mean, to a certain extent, our vision of the past, our memory of the past, is also fictional.
Yes, and I think in a way it's fallible in one sense, but in one sense the fragments are kind of there. We just can't necessarily get them in the right way at the right moments. But I think we do need it to be like that in order to be able to mix it all up to think about the future, because the imagination about the future is so important that it's more important that we can do that than that our memories are perfect. And of course, also, we don't want to remember every single thing we did. There isn't time, if you like. You know, we haven't got the ability to almost have enough room to remember everything we did. We need to just remember the important bits or we'd be overloaded.
Mm. I guess the next biggest question really is, how much control can we have or gain over this entire process? I mean, for instance, one of the things that I most dislike about aging is how time seems to speed up. I can remember how long a year used to seem when I was a child. You know, it would take forever for summer vacation to arrive. And now it's just a year goes by in a snap. I feel like I'm racing toward death, which isn't a good feeling. Is there a way I could slow that down?
It is interesting, our time in our lives, because we look at time in two ways. And there's a thing I call the holiday paradox, where if you go on holiday and it's a good holiday and you're busy, then the holiday seems to go far too fast. Say it's a week's holiday, you get halfway through the holiday and it's already time to think about packing and coming home again. But then when you get home, it feels as if you've been away from work for much longer than a week, and it will even work with just a weekend. And that's because we look at time in two ways. So we look at it prospectively. We say, how fast is it going right now? Am I bored? Am I interested? What's going on? And then we also look back and say, how fast did yesterday feel? And our memories and the number of new memories we make will have a real difference here. So the holiday seems to go fast at the time because you're busy and that's nice. And then you've made loads and loads of new memories. Possibly you might have seen 10, 15 new things each day. So when you look back, compared with a normal routine week, you've made all these memories, so it feels very, very long. So if you apply that to your life, if you want your life to seem long, then what you need to do is to be busy and to fill it up, and to fill it up with new things all the time. So at the weekend, don't keep going to the same restaurant or same bar, say, and don't, you know, just hang around. You do have to trade rest for this, but what you need to do is go and do lots of new things. So do something new on Saturday morning, something else new on Saturday afternoon, something else you've never done before, or a place you've not been to in the evening, walk somewhere different. And when you get to Monday morning, it will feel as if the weekend was long. And that's the same with life. So in a way, when people worry about time going too fast, all the situations where time goes slowly, if you think back to the people feeling rejected, we know that when people are feeling depressed, time goes twice as slowly. When people are feeling lonely, time goes more slowly. So when people say, oh, I really want things to slow down, I sort of question, do we really want that? Because actually, those aren't necessarily the situations we really want. If time seems to be all racing away from you, then that could be a good sign that you're doing lots of things, you're really busy, and when you look back, you will have lots and lots of memories, and it will feel like a long, long life.
Claudia Hammond is a science journalist and host of the BBC Radio 4 programs All in the Mind and Mind Changers. For more about the mysteries of time perception, look for her book Time Warped. Coming up, an unknown chapter in the story of Kurt Vonnegut's life, his years in the PR department at General Electric. Kurt Vonnegut as a company man? And that's even stranger than fiction. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The most famous story about Kurt Vonnegut is the one that led to Slaughterhouse-Five, the story of how, as an American soldier during World War II, he was captured by the Germans and shipped to Dresden, where he survived the Allied firebombing of the city by taking refuge with a group of other POWs in the basement of a slaughterhouse.
We were hungry, we were cold. These sticks of bombs, you know, were walking overhead, either away from us or toward us or whatever. Boom, boom, boom. So our case was quite hopeless, I thought. And he said, as though he were a duchess, a well-fed duchess in a grand, cozy manner, on a terrible stormy night, saying, I wonder what the poor people are doing tonight. And nobody laughed, but everybody was glad he said it because it proved we were still alive.
2 days later, when Vonnegut and the others came up out of that basement, Dresden was gone. Years later, he channeled the experience into his famous novel Slaughterhouse-Five. But meanwhile, his older brother Bernard was back home working as a scientist at General Electric's research lab. And the story most people aren't that familiar with is how Kurt Vonnegut wound up working at GE, too. Ginger Strand tells the story in her new book, The Brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. Steve Paulson talked with her.
So after the war, Kurt Vonnegut comes home, gets married, has kids. works at a series of jobs to try to support his family, which is a struggle. And then in 1947, he gets a job in the PR department at the General Electric Company. Did he get this job through his brother, Bernie?
He did, yes. He had the qualifications for the job in spades. He had worked in newsrooms, and the GE News Bureau, as it was known, was organized like a newsroom. They tried to provide publication-ready stories for newspapers and magazines, and they tried to be as reportorial as they possibly could. They went out and found the stories and reported on things and got quotes. So it wasn't just the usual press agent puffery. So he had this news experience, but he also understood science because he'd been a biochemistry major at Cornell before he enlisted. And that was important to be able to report on the fantastic things that GE was doing. So he went to work for General Electric as a publicity man.
And what was Bernie doing at GE at this time?
This was right around the time that Bernie had discovered that silver iodide, when aerosolized and turned into a smoke, will cause supercooled clouds to release their water vapor as snow or rain. This, of course, was big news at GE and, in fact, around the world. Bernard and his colleagues were celebrities, pretty much. They were celebrity scientists who were going to take control of the weather.
And as you can imagine, the military was also interested in this discovery, too. I mean, if you could control the weather, if you could make it rain or snow, I mean, that had huge strategic implications.
Absolutely. It didn't take very long for the military to get involved. They formed a joint project with GE, and it was good for GE, too, because then they had the military as a kind of bulwark between them and potential lawsuits. So the government was really doing all this work, they said. Their scientists were just consultants. And the military, of course, was very interested in clearing fogs or doing things that would be good for airplanes, but also possibly in using this as a super weapon. Could they learn to steer hurricanes?
Did these experiments actually work? I mean, did they learn how to seed clouds and cause floods and all of that?
So there's some controversy about whether the experiments worked. Certainly, no one ever gained as much control over the weather as the military and everybody else hoped. But they did manage to clear fogs, to make rain. If you have clouds that can potentially make rain, you can increase their productivity.
What did Bernie think about having his research being used by the military?
Bernie absolutely did not want his research to be used to make a weapon. He was very upset by that. And the process that I write about in the book is the process of him coming to understand that he is, in fact, going to have to get political. He's going to have to step out there and say something about what he doesn't want done with his inventions.
So did Bernie go to his bosses and complain?
It's complicated. There are a number of different things going on at once. One thing is that Bernard becomes convinced that the work that they're doing is having bigger effects and possibly more dangerous effects than they even believed it could. And the other thing is that he's concerned about the military use of his invention. So he does, in fact, go to both the people running his own project and to GE and make his position clear.
And what was the response?
Well, of course, they said, don't be ridiculous. Human beings can't possibly change the climate.
So in other words, what was the point of doing the research then?
Yeah, well, they didn't believe. Bernie came to believe that the possible blowback effects were bigger than anyone could have predicted.
Do we know if Bernie and Kurt talked about this research? They were obviously both very interested in science, the ethics of this kind of scientific research. Was this sort of an opportunity for some brotherly bonding?
Absolutely. They talked about this a lot. And Kurt even imports some of the language that Bernie uses when talking about his work into his own novels when he describes Ice 9, a form of ice that's solid at room temperature in Cat's Cradle. He actually uses the language that Bernard used in describing his own invention to Kurt. So there are all these fascinating interplays between the conversations that the brothers were having, and then they get played out in Kurt's fiction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we should talk about this because, I mean, this is really the period when Kurt Vonnegut launched his writing career. I mean, while he was still working at GE, he began work on his first novel, Player Piano. We should talk just a bit about that novel. What was it about?
Player Piano is about a future world, a sort of dystopic future world in which human beings who aren't managers, aren't, you know, white-collar workers, their jobs have been taken over by machines. It's kind of a dark world in which a lot of humanity has no purpose and is trying to find a sense of purpose.
And it's also a society where the engineers and the managers have taken over.
That's right. Yes. The geeks are running everything. It's kind of freakishly prescient.
And how much of that story came out of what Kurt saw at General Electric?
Oh, all of it. All of it. It was such a thinly disguised portrait of General Electric imported into a very near future that not a single bookstore in Schenectady, where General Electric was located, would sell it.
Wow. Just because it was seen as so cutting as to the whole mission of what GE was about.
Yeah, it wasn't in the corporate team spirit. As Kurt later said, I bit the hand that fed me.
Now, I know Kurt Vonnegut was also influenced by the mathematician Norbert Wiener and his whole idea of cybernetics. What was the connection there?
So Wiener wrote this book that was a very complicated book about the future of computers that not many people have heard of today. It was called Cybernetics, and then he later produced a kind of general audience version of it called The Human Use of Human Beings, which could be the subtitle for Player Piano. This has just become so much a part of our world now that we're surprised to hear that someone had to come up with this. But he talked about the brain as a kind of computer and computers as a kind of brain. He started asking the questions that Kurt Vonnegut would go on to ask in all of his work, questions like, what does it mean for humans if computers can think as well as they can?
So Vonnegut was an admirer of Wiener's work, and he sent a copy of Player Piano to him. What did Wiener think about the book?
He did, yes. Vonnegut was hoping, as all of us young writers always hope, oh, I hope my hero will read this book and really admire it, and maybe he'll even say something nice about it to the New York Times. So Kurt had Scribner send a copy of the book to Norbert Wiener, and Wiener got upset. He accused Kurt of setting his novel in the future in order to avoid mounting a critique of science as it was being practiced today. And this was kind of the beginning of something that would torment Kurt for the rest of his career, which was he would be seen as kind of a spacey, futuristic, almost psychedelic, out there guy when he thought he was just writing social satire.
So he wrote this novel. No one at GE liked it. One of his heroes, Norbert Wiener, didn't like it either. what did Bernie think of the book?
Bernie liked the book. Bernie always very much admired Kurt's work, and I think Kurt thought that Bernie thought he was a little weird. But Bernard's sons tell me that he avidly read everything that Kurt wrote and was a big fan of his little brother's work.
And didn't Kurt actually regard General Electric as science fiction?
Yes, he said that later in life when he was asked, why did you choose to write science fiction? He said, I couldn't help it. The General Electric Company was science fiction. And that's very much true. When you look at the sources, the source material, and then his early fiction, he really was writing about things that he saw directly at GE, and he would just kind of exaggerate them a little bit. He would amp them up in order to bring out the moral and ethical questions that they raised.
And this continued then in other books. I mean, for instance, Cat's Cradle. All kinds of questions are raised about the ethical responsibilities of scientists.
Yes, that book is entirely about that question. And Kurt often said later in life that Felix Honecker in Cat's Cradle, the scientist who had invented the bomb and then subsequently invented Ice 9, was modeled on Irving Langmuir, the Nobel laureate chemist who worked with his brother Bernard.
Hmm. What do we make of Kurt Vonnegut's take on science then? I mean, he was immersed in the field and yet wrote about it in not always very favorable ways.
Yeah, Kurt and the relationship between science is almost like a semi-lapsed Catholic. He was someone who grew up loving science and really admiring it and admiring technology and thinking that science would solve the world's problems. And many people felt this way, particularly during the Depression, which is much of Kurt's formative years happened then. And then the Second World War happened. Science dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and on Nagasaki, and everyone began to feel a little different, scientists included. People began to think, what are the moral responsibilities of science now that science is the world's greatest weapon? And it was a little upsetting for people to have to think, science is not just necessarily the thing that will solve all of our problems. It might make new problems that we have to think hard about solving. And I think that that's something that Kurt endlessly tried to work out in his work.
And what about his older brother, Bernie? Did he ever come to doubt what he was doing as a scientist?
During the Vietnam War, Bernard's invention was actually used as a weapon of war against the North Vietnamese. They flew 2,800 cloud-seeding missions over North Vietnam in an attempt to rain on the enemy, which everyone says, oh, well, how bad can that be? Well, it actually could slow them down quite a bit and muddy up the trail that they were bringing the arms to the front with. So it was a useful thing. Bernard was very upset that his invention was used in war, and he was glad when the outcry that resulted led to a UN convention banning the use of weather modification as a weapon of war. That was something he'd always hoped would happen, and it ultimately did. I don't think that Bernard ever lost his love for science, but he certainly agreed with his brother that people should pay attention to science's moral dimensions.
Well, it makes me wonder, as you were working on this book, whether you were reminded of C.P. Snow's famous 1959 lecture, The Two Cultures, you know, when he talked about the breakdown in communication between the sciences and the humanities. And this was he saw it as a major obstacle to dealing with the world's problems. Did you think about that as you were working on this story?
I thought about that a lot, and I really saw this story as a story of two brothers who tried to reach across that divide and who were, because they were able to converse with each other and to learn from one another's work, were able to kind of cross that barrier. Kurt Vonnegut read that essay as well and sometimes pointed out that he, in fact, had both cultures because he had a background in science as well as being an artist.
Ginger Strand is the author of The Brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. She talked with Steve Paulson. Steve also talked with Kurt Vonnegut a few years back. If you want to hear that interview, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.